What's up, guys? Welcome to the Humans of MarTech podcast. His name is John Taylor. My name is Phil Gamache. Our mission is to future-proof the humans behind the tech so you can have a successful and happy career in marketing. What's up, everyone? Today, we have the pleasure of sitting down with Jesenia Francisco, Director of Marketing Operations at Lucid Software. Jesenia started her career in finance at Merrill Lynch and Bank of America. She later pivoted to the nonprofit space, joining the Association of Latino Professionals for America, where she started to get into fundraising operations. She was later recruited by New School's Venture Fund and moved out to the Bay Area and had the opportunity of rolling out Salesforce across her organization. She then joined the Opportunity Fund as a development operations manager focused on improving donor acquisition processes and marketing automation implementation. And Jesenia then made the mega move to Asana, where she started in sales ops and later pivoted to marketing ops and eventually leading MarTech programs and becoming head of marketing automation. Today, she's director of marketing operations at Lucid Software, the creators of the popular flowchart and diagram tool Lucidchart. Jesenia, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you, Phil and John, for having me on today.
This episode is brought to you by our friends at Knack. Launching an email or landing page in your marketing automation platform shouldn't feel like assembling an airplane mid-flight with no instructions, but too often, that's exactly how it feels. Knack is like an instruction set for campaign creation, from establishing brand guardrails and streamlining your approval process to Knack's no-code drag-and-drop editor to help you build emails and landing pages. No more having to stop midway through your campaign to fix something simple. Knack lets you work with your entire team in real time and stops you having to fix things mid-flight. Check them out at knack.com, that's K-N-A-K, and tell them we sent you.
Jesenia, you've spent a considerable part of your career supporting honorable causes like helping Latinos build their careers, reimagining public education so all children have access to schooling, also providing small businesses run by entrepreneurs of color, immigrants and women access to capital and coaching. That sounds super cool. Talk to us about the challenges of working with not-for-profit causes and also some of the benefits that you've had personally and in your career.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny. As you were talking about my background, I was like, oh man, I sound like a saint. I think really where I was in my career was I started off my career in finance. And like most people, they realize this is going to be long term. And so I wanted to find the complete opposite and run from finance. I think it gave me like a really good foundation to my career, but I was really looking for purpose when I moved into the nonprofit space. And I found such a rewarding experience. The escape was really moving away from conversations around profit and loss, right? And really, how do I create impact in someone's life? Or how do I create systematic change? And that's what I was seeking at that point in time. And it's funny, even as I was reflecting on the conversation we were going to have today, I think I was doing operations before operations was the term. Because even back in finance, part of my job was to be an analyst, but the other part was actually to do business analysis and operations type work. So some of the work that I do today just reminds me of all of the foundational work that I did even back in finance. But to think about the nonprofit space, I really found myself motivated, inspired by the stories of the communities that I served in those different nonprofits, which was super helpful for me because that's what I was seeking. I wanted to see the impact, see the change. And what I found myself like really being enamored with the nonprofit world was that they pulled my heartstrings and really made me love the work that I was doing because I could be so close to that story, so close to the person, the business, or the change that was happening overall. And so one moment that I remember really fondly was when I was working at New School's Venture Fund. And it's a mouthful as you talk about New School.
Yeah.
What they are is an education venture philanthropy. And so when you think about a venture fund and like an education nonprofit, they're the merge of that, actually one of the pioneers around it. And so they basically ask for money to get money to give money to educational ventures. And they could be for profit, they could be nonprofit. And what that meant was they had a portfolio around three key initiatives. One was how to create change in school systems. So whether they be a charter school or a district school, how are you innovating and how do we seed that innovation? The second was around how do we integrate technology into education? And that could be like helping kids like know how to build a robot. That could be how do you use rap to teach vocabulary, which was actually a venture. And then the third was around how do you support people of color and the representation of them in those communities, whether it be educators, whether it be being serving on a board or administrators. And so one moment that I remember pretty fondly is we went to do a on-site at a school that provided project-based learning, which for most people, they're like, what is that? Think about like industrial learning within the US, right? You go to school, you read a book, you get tested on it and rinse and repeat. Project-based learning is actually you have a large project that you give to kids across all ages and they go through a systematic process to come out with a learning that is encompassing math, English, social studies. And that's how they learn is like by a project overall. So we visited one in Napa and like the impression that just really spoke to me was we went to a kindergarten class and the kindergarten class was going through a project around like velocity and gravity. And I had a kindergartner come up to me and explain what velocity was, which was like mind blowing. I was like, you,
wow,
you know what velocity is. And so it was just really seeing like funding to that type of initiative and just seeing just the impact even at such a early age that I found so impressionable. And so that was like, again, the great thing that like spoke to me as I thought about being in the nonprofit space. Some of the other things around the benefits of being in the nonprofit is like there's a lot of opportunity to grow in the nonprofit space and really take on stretch projects. And so at that time in my career, I wasn't implementing CRMs. They're like, hey, do you sell software? Go implement this software. And so that really gave me a lot of the foundational knowledge to really build on my sales ops and my marketing ops career, where in several instances, I implemented Salesforce on my own, like tinkering around and using sometimes agencies to help, and then implementing marketing automation tools, where before that, I was just like, oh, don't we use MailChimp? And it's like, how do we get to more sophisticated scaled versions of that. And so I think opportunities are really rampant within nonprofits and it's a great place to grow really quickly if you can really identify those opportunities. I think the other aspect is creative problem solving. And so one term that I've always used is like champagne taste on a beer budget type of thing, right? Like how can you be really scrappy and do things really well? And I think that the nonprofit world really showed me that, which was like, how do you implement something like a Salesforce in a really scaled way? And how do you get creative about the roadblocks that you can actually have, whether that be technical, that can be funding, that can be like a number of things. And like the ability to say, huh, yeah, okay, I got this, right? Can you do this for free for me? And being able to really like implement well once you have like clarity around what the solution would be. So I think like those were all benefits. I think with every industry, there's a pros and cons. And I think for me, like some of the places where I struggled is under resourcing in certain places where I think technology can sometimes be the last place that a nonprofit invests in. Mm-hmm. And that's a struggle. I think career growth and diversity can meet a ceiling. And I think in my case, or at least in my story, I found myself at a place where I was like, okay, I can continue to implement Salesforce over and over again or not. Or I can get something that's a lot more challenging. Or how do I build a data warehouse to connect and integrate? How do I deal with more complex challenges, at least technically? And I just found myself as I was like perfecting my approach to implementing Salesforce that they're like, okay, yeah, I need you. Could you implement Salesforce again? And I was like, or I could build you a data warehouse. Do you have that? And so, yeah, I think you can have a ceiling And then the last thing that I think can be really be a downer is like politics and misalignment of leadership. It's not uncommon to see leadership turnover, like in any industry, but I think certainly in the nonprofit space, when you're in like a tight market, you can have leadership that have no concept of what you're doing, especially if you're in the ops space. And then sometimes politics can really make or break the work that you're trying to do overall.
So great answer, Jasenia. Thank you so much for walking us through the journey there. I didn't have as deep experience early in my career in MPO like you did, but that's where I started my internship career, if you will, when I was in university. So I worked for an agency that helped NPOs. So it's like a marketing agency that worked with NPOs specifically in like the green space, like environmental marketing was like really big back then. And so graduated with that experience and I was like, I'm going into the marketing world and I'm going to work for NPOs and I'm going to play with the coolest tech. And I interviewed with a few NPOs and obviously the entry level salaries were different than tech and the tech stack was way different than some of the tech companies. So I ended up wanting to play with cool new tools, but I'm happy to say that I've turned that back a little bit later on in my career. I still work in tech, but similar type of how do we make the world a better place? We're conquering addiction at my current startup. So super important mission, but I love what you walked us through, like the benefits and the kind of more like struggles of can we get more budget? Do you have NPO pricing? So I get a lot of that. And I'm curious, like when you transition to tech, a lot of your NPO experience was working for smaller companies, right? Like usually the case for a lot of NPOs, I know they range from like 50 to 150 people. But when you went over to tech in San Fran, you joined big enterprise teams. Not sure how big Asana was when you joined in 2019, but they're well over 3,000 people today. Lucid is also over 1,000 people. What advice do you have for folks that are maybe in startups or SMBs today, or even the NPO space that are considering going to enterprise tech? Walk us through that.
Yeah, so it's so funny that you say that because I feel like there's a misnomer that like small is not the place to be. And so like just for scale, when I started at Asana, I was probably around 350 mark in terms of employees.
Wow.
Which is crazy to say now. Sometimes I joke around and I was like, oh, I started at, you know, in terms of my tech career at a small company called Asana. And they're like, that's not small. We were a little bit of a cult classic to a certain extent. But yeah, fairly small when I joined. And I think that kind of going back to that misnomer, like sometimes growth happens so quickly that you don't even realize that business has changed or that the needs have changed. Like smaller companies have such an intimacy to them, whether it be like a small company or a small team, people's quirks. Like something that I really enjoyed was like, oh, the CEO likes to drink Diet Coke. Like that's the thing, right? If you ever need to sweeten a deal, give it to her with a Diet Coke, right? So that's some of the like pieces of being at a smaller company overall. I think you have access to people even across levels, so people feel within reach. I think at a smaller company, you have the ability to drive, roll up your sleeves, and also see the immediate change to the business as you're being like that player. And so the other misconception that people have at a smaller company is that like privilege and pedigree doesn't exist in a smaller company. And I think like an example to scale, like the hottest company that's being talked about is like OpenAI. They're around 200 to 500 people right now. I could see them easily being that Asana scale where it's 200 to 300 now, 3,000 in a year and a half, which is essentially what can happen. So yeah, so I think pedigree and privilege can still exist at a small company. And that's one of the misnomers there. For example, I worked at an organization where we were 30 people max, but most of the leadership was like Ivy League MBAs, which was something that was like, okay, sure. and it skewed towards Harvard. Like the CEO was a Harvard business professor, Harvard grad. And so really smart woman, like you never wanted to really get in. Like little me, I was like, I never want to get into a debate. This woman knows everything. And so, but it did invoke imposter syndrome in me. And one of the best lessons that I learned was that when a company of privilege and pedigree hires you, they're asking you to be part of their A team because they know you can deliver on the A team. And sometimes you think that because you're around that privilege and pedigree that like they hired you for the B team. There is no B team. So I think that was one great lesson that I learned being part of a smaller organization, and especially like an organization. And the same thing was for Asana as well. So many smart people. And sometimes you can get caught up in saying, did they? And it's like to be part of the A team. So you have to bring your A game because they know that you can do it. But I think as I think about the original question around like scaling, I think as a company grows, like some of these aspects that are really unique to a small company can really fade and expectations can grow. And that can pull in terms of different directions overall. So I think the following things have really helped me. So like meeting people and the business where they are, right? So just really understanding like, where are we now and how do we tailor to that as opposed to thinking, how do I tailor to when they're 3,000, right? And sometimes that's like a crawl, walk, run approach. But oftentimes what I'm doing is I'm checking my assumptions, I'm checking for understanding, and I'm leading with empathy, right? Because even some of my stakeholders might have the expectations of being at the 3,000 mark when we're little old 200 person company, right? We have more time to iterate when we get to that 3,000. And I think the other piece around this is like not thinking that just because it worked for you elsewhere, that it'll work here. And so something to be mindful of is specifically around just because it worked at X company, like it'll work here. I tend to be like technology agnostic. People tend to say like, we must bring this software here. And I say, is this software the best for our situation? Not just because you used it. And typically that's with leadership where they're like, I'm a this house and sure, but now you're at this place. What works here? So I think that's one piece. The other advice that I would give in that situation is like scaling yourself and process. So like moving from a small company to large or just being at a larger company, you have a larger charter, you have more stakeholders, you have global offices, and this is really a test of scale. Right. And so if your processes are failing, you need to go back and really iterate.
I had a follow up and then I want to ask my question about Lucidchart. But like you touched on something that I thought was really important and some of our listeners will probably key off of, which is this idea of imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. And yet you're providing this like extremely grounded approach in terms of how you ground yourself in an organization and you find yourself battling the tides of complexity. Being tool agnostic, recognizing the level you're at, but also the next level that you can reach to. I'm sure some listeners, maybe like myself, have dealt with imposter syndrome over your career, like in marketing operations. We work with lots of smart people, data engineers, developers, and so on, who can make us feel not so smart. How have you tackled imposter syndrome for yourself? And now that you manage teams, how do you recognize that within your team members and help them overcome those obstacles?
I skew towards emotional intelligence. And so I'm constantly in a like reflecting period. And I tend not to react to the situation at hand. And sometimes that means, hey, there's a concept that's like blowing my mind in a meeting. I need some time to digest, right? And come back with a formed opinion. I think that the theme here is collaboration. It's a team effort, right? So when we acknowledge that you have to pass the baton, it changes things in that mentality overall. And so I think I've just come to realize that I can't do it alone. And I think professionally, what I've done is ask for help, right? And that's break down this concept for me, for my technical partners. And that can be humbling. Like, hold on, let's read this again. Okay, and let's break this down. And actually, that has been a bridge builder as opposed to a blocker, where I've worked with technical parts where I was like, hold out, I really want to understand this. Break this down to me. Let's work through what's the concept, what's the analogy, and really understanding that. So yeah, so I think asking for help, and I think professionally I've done it that way. Personally, you pointed out to a couple of times I've pivoted. I have been really intentional that as I've pivoted, I've created communities around me to really support me in those aspects. And so just finding myself when I am hitting topics that I don't understand, like just reaching out to the community. And so I think like during COVID, like communities, especially MOPS communities, like completely blew up. And so I would often tell my team or people that I worked with, here's the 13 Black communities that I'm part of. And when I don't know a topic, I'm like, what is this? Please help me. Please meet with me, at least for some virtual coffee. And just asking there or researching enough to make an opinion. And so I think, like, to the other point that you talked about, like, now I have teams under me. And so the thing that I iterate to them over and over again is the most important aspect of the work that we're doing is for you to have an opinion around your subject matter expertise. Because I can't be in every room. And if you have no opinion, you're going to come back to me and say, Jesenia, what's your opinion? And the most important thing as a leader is that I don't have all the opinions, because I can tell you my opinion. I was a very opinionated baby. I was very opinionated to my parents. I'd be like, I don't think that's how they should do it. And they're like, what do you know of the world? So I have tons of opinions, but I think the most important opinion is often the opinion of my team and the opinion that people can rally around. And that's not necessarily my own.
Yeah.
Love that. John has four opinionated babies at home, so I'm sure
you know
what you're talking about.
Oh, I've got tons of opinions, especially about what we're having for dinner every night. Anyways, we just choose it. The bosses in the house make it and we serve it.
This episode is also brought to you by our friends at Census. Census is a data activation platform loved by marketing teams at Sonos, Canvas, Crocs, Notion, and more. As a customer, I've experienced the magic of Census firsthand. Their no-code audience hub and reverse ETL enable me to use our cloud data warehouse to power growth and create highly personalized customer journeys in all of my marketing platforms like Iterable and Google Ads. If you like the Humans of Martech podcast graphics and you want your very own image, we're doing a monthly raffle for a personalized t-shirt designed by us. Enter to win at getcensus.com/humans.
Jesenia, you touched on so many kind of interesting concepts, and I think it gives us me a nice little segue to nerd out a little bit about Lucid Chart. So years ago, I was a marketing operations consultant, no more, but one of the things that I had working with my clients was explaining things in my head about how things work under the hood. One of my old bosses used to say to me all the time, John, you can explain things to people, but you can't understand it for them. But for me, Lucidchart became a way for me to explain these things. So like I became a power user of a Lucidchart. Actually, your sales team reached out to me and I pitched an idea that I never followed up on. My fault. I called it Kung Fu Marketing with Lucidchart because I felt like a martial arts expert, like punching and kicking way above my weight. But I did find MOPS has this challenge of being able to explain the complex processes to other stakeholders. Something we talk about so often on this show is just like, how does MOPS communicate the little wins to people? And sometimes our little wins are really technical. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the challenges of communications in MOPS.
Yeah, that speaks so much to me, mainly because oftentimes the work that we're doing is explaining complex concepts to an average user or stakeholder. And it's often like what I feel is a translation problem or a communication issue. I think for me, like I speak multiple languages, so I'm always constantly translating between, this is what we would say in Spanish, but that's not a one to what that means in English. And so I think there's a little bit of empathy there. And oftentimes I use a couple of tactics. So one, right on the nose, like Lucidchart is a great way to like visually conceptualize things for people. And so it's a great bridge builder. I think like it can be so powerful if it's done correctly, and sometimes it can be done incorrectly, right? Like you can still make a really complex Lucidchart and bring it to, yeah. Like, ooh, all I see is wiggly lines to other words. So you're like, not what I meant to do. This is just the complexity in a visual format. But I think it's a couple of topics. So one, like we're in our own world. So I think as like an operator, it's hard to break out of like being in our world and being able to share a concept or like the importance or the why. And so I think for me, I tend to use analogies and tailor visuals or documentation to the audience, because I think we blanketly say, oh, there's an audience. It's one audience. And in reality, you're speaking to multiple audiences and you really need to ground them. And so I think visuals when it makes sense. I think sometimes visuals can deter in some cases. And then I think that analogies is a good one for me. I think going back to one of the analogies, champagne tastes on a beer budget, right? Like everybody knows what that is, right? Like small budget, but you want sales force. That's hard, right? So analogies tend to really work for me. And then I would say the other piece that has been really helpful is around terminology. And you'd be surprised around, I just had a conversation this morning where we were talking about lead lifecycle with someone on my team. And they're like, what does that mean to you? And I was like, this is a great grounding conversation, right? Because how do you expect with such a broad term for everyone to really understand what that means and really define expectations in the same way? And so one key thing that I've done to like presentations or even visuals is have a term sheet, especially for enrichment. I've done this where I was like, enrichment isn't prospecting, right? It isn't intent data. Those are all different things. Like there's firmographic, demographic. And so pulling those out, because when you're talking about these concepts, if they all feel like it's bundled, you're never going to be able to land all the concepts. So putting in decks, like key terms, having some visuals, making sure they're simple, and then bringing in as many analogies as possible is super helpful. I also will say that while I've done all those things, there's just times where people are just like, I don't know what you're talking about. And as you grow in leadership, influencing to be able to do that. And sometimes that means like prepping an executive to tell their other executive friend, like, here's what she needs you to know. And I've done like bullet points, like here are the five things I need you to hit. Here's a visual. Tell it to your friend.
Very cool. That's super powerful advice. There's a bunch that I want to pull a thread on there. But I love your point about analogies, especially in marketing ops. It can be so powerful. And one analogy that's actually been a key theme for me in my career is this idea of eating your own dog food. I've worked at companies not specifically geared to marketers, but I got to use the product and understand how it works, like from a BI tool to CRM. And when I was at WordPress, I used WordPress extensively, like our podcast site is created on WordPress. Mm-hmm. So you're similar in the sense that having been an employee at Asana and Lucid, you've experienced using the products from an internal perspective. I'd love for you to unpack, like, how has this influenced your day-to-day in marketing ops specifically?
Yeah, I would say in both cases, like marketing ops is like a key persona. So I've used it in the most extreme sense. And I think in both cases in Lucid and Asana, like we use it for things that we probably shouldn't be using it for. You're just like, maybe you should think about this other tool who does it better. Not a competitor.
Let's stretch it. Let's see if it works.
Yeah, not another competitor. I'm not saying to go to a competitor, but we can't search in this tool. So, yeah, I think the definition of collaboration is just different. It takes on a different meaning because I've worked in collaborative software. And so that means for me, like I'm highly relying on automation, like core functionality of tools. At Asana, we had projects for intakes with extreme automation to the point where, for example, campaign operations across the regions, anytime something came in from email, that got auto-triggered to that person in region. Right? Which most people would be like, oh, just triage, but not when you have maybe 20 to 50 tickets coming in a day. Nope. I think at Lucid, what that means is like, it's visual a lot of the time. And so just finding that healthy balance in terms of what is visual versus what actually needs words can be like the thing that we utilize. But I think there's a power in actually collaboration tools and integrations together. For the most part. And what I would say is like finding a foundation in the collaboration tool of our choice and then partnering and integrating with other tools to really supercharge our workflows has been really at the center of my work overall. We're probably one of the primary use cases of both of those softwares and also the biggest advocates of dog fooding overall. So I've been in multiple instances saying this wouldn't work for like a marketing use case, or here's the things that you need to know for this persona specifically. And so I've had the privilege of being able to like dog food truly and really see how these collaboration tools can like supercharge your workflows. And I think I use it to extreme sense in both aspects, both at Lucid and when I was at Soma.
Mm-hmm. Just switching gears a little bit. One of the things I was looking through your LinkedIn threads and I saw you brought up a couple of things around leads and contacts. And one of the things that came to mind was like, in marketing ops, this is a bit of a joke, but serious. One of the most challenging questions you can ever get is, how many MQLs have we generated this year? And it's like a moving target report that people have to build and it can break brains. Many MOPS people have died trying to solve this equation for you. It depends on how many you want. I've seen you write about other MarTech tools like Lean Data, Ring Lead. Like, there's so many ways to solve marketing operations problems. Sometimes it's building like a really cool Tableau dashboard that merges all the data together. So I think this is something that can be really challenging for marketing ops people. Like, we live in this wonderful era where there's 75 billion MarTech tools coming out every day. How do you choose between just like implementing new MarTech solutions versus doing something the old fashioned way, rolling up your sleeve? How do you choose where you solve your problems in marketing operations?
Yeah, I think it goes back to really understanding what the stakeholder wants. And I feel like this is an age old problem where sometimes you have marketers, at least in marketing ops, bring you a solution. They're like, what I really need is this tool. And you're like, why? And they're like, because the tool's cool. You're like, not one you pay six figures for. Cool isn't on the business case. So I think it's just really getting down to like, what is really the need and going through several iterations of that and really understanding that really well. I think, and most people in marketing operations will agree, like a tool will never really solve your problems, right? Especially off the shelf. Actually, the one person, and this was back in my nonprofit time, the one person who I found who was really happy with software was because he was at a venture fund and basically they gave him a budget to create his own CRM. And he was like, I love it. And I was like, of course you do. You have an army of engineers. He showed me like a functionality where he could like upload pictures. He's, this is the coolest thing. I was like, yeah, because you have unlimited budget and an army of engineers. I would love it too if I could build my CRM, my own CRM on my spare time. So yeah, so I think it's about really just understanding what the need is and having options. I'm a big proponent of options and guiding people along the way to really find what the right solution is. And in most cases, especially going back to like smaller and larger organizations, I'm at much larger organizations where we have to work with business systems or enterprise technology teams. And they're also like, don't bring me a solution. So I just bring three options and I'm like, great, you pick the best one or give me an option that doesn't exist. But I think it's going back, like for the stakeholder, really understanding their need, bringing multiple solutions to the table, and then coming together and really bringing people, especially if you're working with other teams like that, to really come up with the best solution once you've weighed pros and cons there. It can be really easy to say, I know how to fix this. And I try to avoid that and say, okay, there's 3 to 4 ways that we can go about this. Let's stress test until we really meet your need and let go. And sometimes that's hard. Let go of that tool and really test if that tool is going to really meet your needs. There have been some other approaches, especially for more niche or nuanced like bodies of work, that I have said, let's pilot. Let's test if these tools can do that. And that's a privilege. Not every person has that where you're like, we can bang on our brand recognition to get a proof of concept up. But I think in some places, for example, the community space, there's not a lot of tooling there. So how do you figure out what tooling is going to give you the big bang for your buck or really meet the need of what your community program is and the value that it provides? Because community means so many different things. And then I think the other places like generative AI as well, trying to figure out what's going to really work for us. Cause they're like, check GPT. And I was like, nah, you're not, especially from a legal sense. I don't know if legal is going to let us have access to this unlimited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you made the segue to our next question super easy, Jasenia. But I was going to like pick up on the thread about piloting tools and getting a POC in place before you commit to something, especially when someone's coming in saying, I don't really know what problem this is solving, but this is a cool tool and I want to give this a shot. I feel like in the next few years, there's going to be a lot of that with AI and Gen AI. One thing that we've noticed a lot talking with guests on the show recently is this idea that MOPS teams are in this interesting position to be the stewards of AI tech within their companies. MOPS works at this kind of cool intersection between a lot of the MarTech, but also sales tech and revenue tech. So in your opinion, do you think MOPS teams can be this champion of AI initiatives? And if not, is it another team? Is it kind of like this council of other teams? And curious, what skills do you think listeners should be working on when thinking of, I want to be someone who is deploying new AI tech at my company?
Yeah, I think it's one, really understanding the landscape in which those tools work. So what I would say on our end is like, we tend to be conservative around AI specifically because there's just a lot that's unknown and privacy is such a big aspect here. So like when you put those two unknowns, legal's my best friend. We talk all the time. Because yes, I think MOPS can be stewards of them, but I think if you're just saying that it's like you're on the cool train, you're not going to get very far because once you get into a conversation with legal, they're going to ask you the hard questions. What is this? How is the AI training on data? What type of data? And so I think really just understanding those concepts really well as you navigate wanting to champion those tools itself, really having a good understanding of the tech stack and what is, because I think everyone's jumping on, like, I joked about it recently where I was like, everyone's calling their AI like Copilot, right? So really just understanding like the features that are coming out in existing tooling, right? To really understand that overlap. Do you need to get another AI tool if on your roadmap there is already AI components being embedded in some of those tools? And how to get ahead of that curve, I think, is super important. Understanding the concepts and understanding really where the value is. And so what I would say, one like quick and easy way, this is like a common problem at multiple organizations, is like sales writing emails. We all know they hate, I'm not going to generalize, but not all salespeople are great at writing their own emails or content. And I think that AI there, or even like content marketing, is really a great place to be a champion and the low hanging fruit. I think we're still in the early stages. I would say the last tool that I bought that was generative AI was probably like a year and a half ago. And I was very skeptical of it. And it was really because we were having a problem with content and content being delivered globally for sales. And so we jumped on the bandwagon with a proof of concept to buy a tool to help us scale, especially when you're talking about sales departments of 100, right? Like, how do you get the message right? And how do you give personalization at scale to a sales organization across not only that many people, but also regions and localization? And I think we're just still in the early stages of it. I haven't seen a lot of tools that can really localize content for global organizations really well. I can think of one example of one tool that I heard that they can do it. And I'm really interested because even some sales enablement tools can't pick up different languages. And when you're in a global organization, I don't know what it said in Japanese. It looks like they're at office. Right. So I think, yeah, I think generative AI for content, I think, is a great low-hanging fruit that people can really explore and get some wins in. I think it's hard to see some of the other automation pieces because I'm of the mindset that sometimes when you over-automate, you can create more havoc in certain places because you can't see everything. You can't control it.
One of my follow-up questions for this is, we've covered AI on the show so much, but you touched on a few things that I thought were valuable for us to just unpack. And maybe just one aspect of that is this like hype cycle versus the use case. I'm a power user of AI. I use it constantly for way too many use cases, but I also don't think it's the answer to all of our problems. I just made a post on LinkedIn where I'm like, it's a tool, but if you think it's a hammer, then everything's going to start looking like a nail. How do MOPS leaders start to understand where does this tool fit into the overall use case? Like, what kind of process or thought exercise can people put in place to actually get through the hype, get through all the prompt engineering stuff that's out there, and get to something of substance and value for your team?
Yeah, I think about repeatable processes and scale. If you're having a scale problem, and so like in that use case when we did do that pilot, we were having a scale problem. Like we had one content marketer per region supporting too many from a ratio perspective, and then being able to provide personalization, which I think a lot of companies struggle with. And so in that case, that's where I was like, I think that this is what can be applied. And it was something that like a user brought to us. And when I first heard of it, I was like, you can't do this. And then I did see the power of it. And I think stress testing, I think scale overall, I think is a good place. But I think understanding where there's human intervention in the case of AI, I use ChatGPT. I actually showed my sister how to use it. She's currently doing her master's. And she was like struggling and she was like, oh, I have to create like a one page paper on a summary of this, but I have bullet points and I just need an output. And I was like, oh, you just use ChatGPT. And she was like, ChatGPC? I was like, no worries, just give me the inputs. We'll spit it out. And 15 seconds, we spat it out. And she's, oh, send me the link to the ChatGPC. And I was like, yeah, okay, don't worry. I'm pretty sure you'll use this for more of your master's.
Yeah. So I think I'm thinking over our AI transcription tool is going to have a fun time figuring out what ChatGPC is and GPT. But yeah, I think that's a great point on thinking about the fundamentals, like what are the things that are going to help us scale? There's a lot of shiny objects right now, especially with AI tools. And how do we like prioritize the list of things that will help us reach our business goals versus just trying to try something and do a POC because someone at the company thinks it's a cool tool. But yeah, just any idea, like we could probably have a whole separate podcast episode on GPT or AI topics. We're getting close on time. So we have two last questions for you. Wanted to save a bit of time to ask you about women in revenue. I know you're part of the group. And one thing you do there that you're, I know, very passionate about is mentoring. And I'd love for you to talk to the audience about what is this idea of mentoring with women in revenue that is really shaking things up for women, tackling the tough spots in revenue roles, whether it's sales or marketing? Like, in what ways is it a game changer for some of the mentees that you have in terms of their career paths?
Yeah. And so one of the things I really love about women in revenue is it's women helping women. And I think that especially in terms of women in the workplace, there are examples where women are really helpful, and there's also examples of where women haven't been helpful. And I've had examples in my career of women who I thought would bring me up, and in some cases they were a blocker. And so women in revenue contained pretty much executive women and then women on the rise for the most part. And so what I love about it is that I have access to CMOs, CROs, and people who are just really tenured. And when I had those questions about career growth and how to navigate these things, those were my community. That's who I reached out to. And I think as a woman, sometimes you're in rooms full of men, right? So how do you navigate those dynamics? And I think what I've really learned is how to navigate those with grace by learning from those other women. And then also, how do I give to other women who are seeking that as well? And so personally, I've mentored. We have a mentoring program, really robust one, where we've done that for probably maybe 4 years with Women in Revenue. We have a platform. We match people. We're a global organization as well. We have people in Asia Pac and EMEA who are mentors and part of our community. And so there's a lot of diversity there in terms of people's experiences, people's tenure, and can really just share their experience and how to grow overall. And it's just been really rewarding to connect with other marketing operations women and just help them navigate what's the next step, help them navigate, I tend to call it like gendered conversations. It sounds a lot more serious, what it is. Just really navigating those conversations with grace in the sense of technical conversations or just boundaries often. So it feels like a sisterhood, honestly. And it's so funny. I have a friend in Women in Revenue, and she's older and definitely more tenured. And she was like, "You mentor me." And I was like, oh, wow. I didn't even realize what I was giving and the value that I'm providing, because it's been so selfless to give to a community that has given me so much in terms of direction. And just say direction, and I'm trying to find what the other word is, but grace, knowing, stats, competence, I think, as well, because they've broken through that layer for me to come through that and come through that knowing and probably a little less bruised than they did. So it's been fantastic. And like, our membership is free. And so there are no barriers to really join. And again, going back to that sisterhood, it keeps me coming back and coming back for more in terms of giving, and also when I'm in the privilege to be receiving as well.
Such a cool community. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think the part that John and I can do is refer the Women in Revenue to our colleagues. And I've done so already in the past. Like I spoke with Chrissy from CS2, who's also part of Women in Revenue, and she spoke very highly about the group as well. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. Super powerful. JT, last question for Jesenia.
Jesenia, thank you so much for joining us on the show. This has been a really fun episode for us. We ask all of our guests this question. You're a MOPS director, a Women in Revenue board member, a mentor, a recent dog mom, sailing hobbyist, also a candle maker. You have endless hobbies to match your deep curiosity. One question we ask all our guests is, how do you remain happy and successful in your career? How do you find balance between all the things you're working on while staying happy?
Yeah, I think I've always found myself in a place where too much of one thing is bad for you. Like, I take that philosophy everywhere. Too much of work is bad for you. Too much overindulgence in your personal life is bad for you. And I think over the last probably year and a half, what I've tried to do is listen to myself and where I find joy. Overall, I think sometimes you can lose yourself in work, and that can be detrimental health, mental, physical wise. And I found myself in those situations. And I think to like that balance point is like, how do I get a little bit of everything done? And then how do I connect with joy? And I think joy can feel like such a term that's out of reach. And I mean it in the most simplest sense. Like this last year and a half, I've put myself in places where I would experience and just say, how do I smile? Like smile authentically where I'm shining bright. And that's brought me to all those different things that I do with Women in Revenue, being a dog mom, just finding joy and like finding myself like truly radiantly smiling and saying, oh, that means I'm on the right path. And so I think I try to listen to myself as much as possible. I try to take on what I know I can handle and then try to say no. I would say I'm not perfect at doing that. I sometimes can be overwhelmed. And when I'm overwhelmed, I just shut out. And I think what I've been practicing over the last few years is like how I'm saying like, here's my boundary. And I just don't have any more to give beyond that. And that's okay. Like human, I don't come with unlimited giving capacity. So that's been my practice, like just finding joy. And it's so funny because I took a road trip. I was sharing with you that I took a road trip over the last couple of months as I moved from California to the East Coast. And I found myself reflecting on pictures as I drove across. And there's so many pictures of me just smiling. Right. And saying perfect, on the right path. Right. And just like, how do I smile and know that I'm on the right path doing exactly what I need to?
Amazing answer, Jesenia. You've made both of us smile a lot throughout the conversation on the show here. I know I'm sure a lot of our audience did as well. So thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time. And I will share links to all the stuff you guys got going on at Lucid, but also Women in Revenue. And really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This episode was brought to you by Iterable. Where will you be on April 30th, 2024? AI and creativity are colliding, and Iterable's signature Activate Summit is the place to be. The automation game is changing and you've got an opportunity to be a key player. Are you ready? Not just should you attend the conference, but you actually have an opportunity to win a full VIP experience. Iterable is giving away a grand prize package that'll whisk you away to San Jose for the summit and take care of everything in style. We're talking a full pass to Activate Summit. That's $1,000 worth of learning, networking, and inspiration with hundreds of marketing's brightest minds. A swanky VIP dinner to mingle with fellow attendees and speakers. A luxurious three-night stay at Signia by Hilton San Jose. Picture plush comfort and stunning views just steps away from all the action. And also a round-trip airfare within the U.S. to leave all the logistics to Iterable. Just focus on packing for your excitement. Entering is super easy. Just head over to iterable.com/activate before April 2nd and register for either in-person or the virtual experience, which is free. And that's it. You're officially in the running. So don't miss out on this chance to win a trip that'll boost your career and ignite your marketing mojo. Head over to iterable.com/activate and enter today. If you're still listening, first of all, thank you for being here. And as a reward for your attention, I'll leave you with my favorite newsletter. Check out the Marketing Operations Leader newsletter written by a friend of the show, Daryl Alfonso. You might know him. We interviewed him in episode 101 of the podcast. Daryl's led marketing ops at big names like Indeed and AWS. And his newsletter is packed with practical advice and frameworks and new ideas to help you manage your marketing function. He launched it at the end of last year and he's already collected over 1,000 subscribers. So go to substack.com and search for Marketing Operations Leader and you'll thank us later. Our second favorite newsletter is the Humans of MarTech newsletter, of course. We'll be experimenting more with this in the future, but for now, think of this as the best way to get notified when a new episode drops. And you'll get a breakdown of the summary of the episode and all the key takeaways. So you know if this is an episode you want to listen, check out, maybe you want to watch it on YouTube or just read the GPT-powered summary blog post. It's the best way to support the show and help us attract more sponsors. So if you like the show, you like our content, you can support us by signing up at humansofmartech.com. Again, really appreciate you and we'll catch you next week.